I'm very pleased to welcome back to Fremantle Shipping News and View from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University. Welcome, Martin.
Welcome, Michael. It's always good to have a chat.
Martin, just a week ago and today was the 25th of April, Anzac Day in Australia. It's the day we reflect on our position in the geopolitical world, really, the day we monumentally went to war. Veterans way back then in 2015 landed at Gallipoli, and ever since we've talked about Australia's role in the in that world, the extent to which we have huge navies and armies and air forces, who our allies are, and of course these days we talk about our relationship with China, less so Russia, I think, but China in our part of the world. Coincidentally, last Friday, a week ago, on the 26th of April, the New York Times published a major article written by John Ismay, Edward Wong, and Pablo Robles, all defense Pentagon conflict thinkers and journalists, entitled A New Pacific Arsenal to Counter China. And the graphics in it are just more telling than the written words. They depict where all of the American bases are, either alone or with partners in South Korea, Japan, Philippines, Papua New Guinea, and Australia, including Darwin and the three big towns on the east coast in Queensland. Interestingly, it doesn't actually show Fremantle and or Perth, but the very last photograph in the story is entitled or captioned the USS North Carolina, a Virginia-class submarine docking in Perth, Australia last year. And we on the Shipping News, of course, have featured those Virginia-class submarines docking down at Garden Island. The article makes reference, in fact, to a new multi-billion dollar agreement called AUKUS for Australia, the United Kingdom and the United States, saying that it'll permanently transfer some of the US Navy's newest Virginia-class attack subs to Canberra. That then, for me, confusingly says the location of the new bases for those subs has not been announced. But the first group of Australian sailors who will crew them graduated from nuclear power training in America in January. And there's an article with the photograph of the three lieutenant commanders in question. I thought Fremantle was clearly in Garden Island, the location. But leaving that aside, Martin, you've read this article. It paints this incredible picture about how America, with its partners, including Australia, are lining up against China. There's no doubt about it, is there?
Oh, look, I think it's the worst kept secret for some years now, Michael, is that a lot of the US's defence strategy in the Asia Pacific is focused on containing China, and actually a lot of our defence strategy is focused on, the China is never mentioned in defence white papers, but it's always implied, and they're seen as the single biggest threat in our. And I think you and I have had some conversations before around China and the unique position that we're faced, because on the one hand, we trade with them left, right, and centre. On the other hand, militarily, we're preparing for them. And this notion of this Asia-Pacific link is very much focused around that and designed to strategically link up a number of different partnerships. So there's some really interesting things. I was in Canberra recently. It's about a month or two ago, Michael, to hear the president of the Philippines address the Australian Parliament. That just was coincidence. I didn't go there for that purpose, but it was really interesting coincidence. And he was very specific and belligerent about China's imperialist ambitions, as he called it, and the Philippines' need to stand up to them, and the Philippines' desire to have the US and Australia stand in their corner. So it's very, it was much more explicit than I expected. It does show how increasingly countries are becoming quite open about the military threat of China and how they need to counter it. Of course, the Philippines is directly competing land interests or sea interests in the South China Sea with China. which sharpens that sense of conflict. We don't have that, but as the graph that you're referring to shows, we occupy a really clear strategic location when it comes to the potential threat of China and the need to counter China because of where we sit. So you've got the Philippines, yes, you've got PNG, and that's another whole interesting issue about this wrestling for influence in PNG and other Pacific Islands. And then you've got Australia, so Philippines, PNG, and Australia. You mentioned Perth, and Perth has a really distinct role because Perth looks west. Unlike the rest of Australia, Perth looks west. So Perth is our gateway to the Indian Ocean.
The
So if
same
you're talking about,
timeline as Beijing and Tokyo.
we are. Well, Tokyo is actually one hour ahead of us,
Yes.
but the same exactly the same timeline as Eastern China. The big cities in China. So we are really important there, and we're important as a strategic outpost into the Indian Ocean as well. So it's very interesting to see how the US really sees us as fairly very significant to their defense.
And you mentioned the Philippines leader being in Canberra a month ago, but the Philippines leader and the Japanese leader, the leader of Japan, have each been in the Washington, D.C. meeting with President Biden in very recent times as well. So it's very clear from the timing of this sort of article, those visits and everything else that's going on, that the Biden administration is taking the repositioning of the American forces in the Pacific in relation to China quite seriously.
Oh, yeah, certainly. And that's why I think you'll find the president of the Philippines, as a former colony of the US, will get a fairly easy path into the White House whenever they want it. So plenty of leaders of Pacific Islands would find it difficult to have a regular meeting with Joe Biden every time they rock up at the White House. Not so the president of the Philippines. They're seen as a key ally. You'll remember as well his predecessor, Duterte, who was a bit of a Trumpian figure in the Philippines, and no one quite knew which way he was going to jump on some of these issues. Whereas his successor, who is actually the son of the dictator, Marcos, is much more conventional in terms of his where he sits and his relationship with the US.
Martin, it's really interesting the language that gets used as well. Admiral Paparo of the U.S. Navy is in charge of this part of the world for the U.S. is quoted in this article in terms which you'd be surprised, I think, to hear an Australian admiral speaking in. They say to Admiral Paparo, this growing network of partnerships and security agreements across thousands of miles of the Pacific is a direct result of what he calls China's, and I quote, revanchist, revisionist, and expansionist agenda, close quote, in the region that has directly threatened its neighbours. And then he says, I do believe that the US and our allies and partners are playing a stronger hand and that we would prevail in any fight that arose in the Western Pacific. And then he added, it's a hand that I would not trade with our would-be adversaries. And yet, we're also never satisfied with the strength of that hand and always looking to improve it. Sounds like a football coach saying why they're going to win the Grand
It
League.
does. It does have football coaching, tone to it, doesn't it? And it's also a little bit more belligerent that you get from a. You'll get that from a retired admiral more than a current one. You'd hope that your current admiral is a little bit more measured in their comments. It's a little bit Trumpian too, in that bombastic language. I, for one, I think that it's really important that we are looking at ways of dialogue with China and trying to resolve issues. It is always worrying and challenging if it's turning into an arms race in the Asia Pacific, where China's pouring ever more money into their defense forces, and so are we, and so is the US, and so is Philippines. There's a In an ideal world, there's a lot of other issues that we need to resolve that you may not have money for, but you end up spending ever more money on defense. So it'd be better ultimately for the US and China to have a healthy relationship.
Mark, just occasionally in life, you sort of taken up towards the clouds and you can look down on everything and you see the world or the place you live or the people you know in a very particular context. Truth, reality sometimes can be revealed with the bird's eye view. For me, this article had that sort of effect. I'm lifted up. I'm looking down on the region. It's made clear to me once again how close Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, not to mention the rest of the South, East Asian countries like Malaysia, Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, the Pacific Islands, and we all are to China and just where Taiwan is. And you're left with the impression that Australia, through AUKUS, is really just part of this countering the China strategy. It's not really about defending Australia as such. We just have to be part of this because that's the geopolitical position that we adopted after the Second War.
You did right that last bit, especially where it's the geopolitical situation been in since the Cold War, not Cold War, since the end of World War II, and the trade-off, our bargain, so to speak, is that we get military support from the US, but the trade-off is we're part of the sphere of US influence, and then we are singing to the same tune when it comes to particularly our defence policies in our region. So the submarines, I see that as very much linked in there. It's a trade-off where we know we're going to spend a lot of money, but it's actually part, this AUKUS relationship is about firming up that relationship with the US in particular and then the UK. So this is what we've signed up to. And we should, discuss, debate that. Some people will agree, some people think that there's some troubling and concerning things. But it shouldn't be uncontentious just because it's defense.
It does, though, seem to me it's a decision taken, and it's taken in a bipartisan sense. That is to say, the major parties all understand and agree to it. There's a paragraph in this article which is obviously very well sourced, and the writers who I mentioned earlier know what they're talking about. And I quote: "Last year, the Biden administration greatly elevated its commitment to Australia, which is one of America's most important non-NATO allies." And after that, they're going to point out that the Virginia-class subs that we've been talking about can fire torpedoes and Tomahawk missiles, which will potentially add to the number of threats Beijing faces in case of a regional war. I mean, that's why they're here. That's the nature of the AUKUS agreement. There's no stepping back from it. There can't be a stepping back from it, can there? It's simply a continuation of everything that's been going on for the last 70, 80 years in our world.
Oh, it does certainly seem like a really inevitable trajectory. Not necessarily inevitable that direct military conflict will break out. One of the things that you look back at the Cold War in a fairly reassuring way, Michael, is that despite coming to the precipice a couple of times, particularly in 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the USA and USSR stared each other down for a good 3 or so decades and more, and never came into direct conflict. And thankfully, nuclear arms were not used during that period. And eventually, there was reform and change and in Russia, are we that far away from where we were? I hope that well, we're not returning to a Cold War situation. A Cold War is better than direct conflict, Michael. So you sometimes feel we're sort of moving towards a bit of a Cold War type situation with the US and China, where all these small Pacific islands and other countries in the Asia Pacific have to pick a side and stick with it.
Well, I was sort of bemused in a way that Bob Carr, the former Australian Foreign Minister, is suing Winston Peters, or at least he's taking the steps to enable him to do so, after they had a bit of a spat on New Zealand radio recently. Did you see that?
I did. Look, it is a fascinating spat. I think that the two of them help identify those differences. Bob Carr, for some years, has been a Sinophile, pretty much for most of the time since he left politics. He's very strong in advocating for making peace with China, embracing the sort of Chinese vision, trade, economics, etc. Very critical of the Morrison government for the poor relationship, etc. But I think he's been accused himself of not having any balance in what his comments are, and then he doesn't understand or appreciate the full complexities there. And you got Winston Peters. Now, Winston Peters is not a figure that familiar to Australians, but he's been a regular feature of New Zealand politics for several decades now, and he's actually partnered with both Labor and National Conservative governments in New Zealand. He leads an NZ First Party, New Zealand First Party, which is not a Pauline Hanson one, but it is very, a bit nationalist. And his broader mantra is look after New Zealand first and look after other people afterwards. So he's currently Deputy Prime Minister because he's a junior coalition partner. So he's probably more on the stand up to China side, or certainly more on the stand up to China side. And you can see how they're conflicted. I think defamation is a bit of a tall order myself, Michael. And if anything we've seen recently is defamation can often blow up in one's face if ill considered. So there's a lot of threats for defamation that don't always follow through.
Well, I mean, someone was bound to comment on what Bob Carr actually he said, that this whole fracas has been reported as triggered by the remarks Carr made during his visit to New Zealand last month, where he described technology-sharing element of the AUKUS pact as, quote, fragrant methane-wrapped bullshit, close quote. And then he went on to explain, why do I call it bullshit? Because it's been cobbled together to make it look like there's more to AUKUS than subs. There isn't. So you get the impression he's generally, from Bob Carr's point of view, critical of the AUKUS agreement and doesn't think much of it.
Yeah, that's very consistent with his broader theme and the way he's gone about things. A lot of alliances, and there's certainly some truth in what he says. Australia was already in a close military alliance with the US. Australia's already enjoyed strong military and more diplomatic and cultural ties with the UK. It's hardly headline grabbing. But at the same time, diplomatic relationships and agreements, Michael, are often for show. They're often window dressing. They're virtue signaling. You're signaling to other people that you're close. And that's not uncommon in diplomacy. Diplomacy is a lot about words, and the words are actually designed to prevent other conflict. It's the use of politics internationally to prevent other forms of conflict and tension. So it's not that different from a lot of other arrangements and alliances in that respect.
Language is such a difficult thing, isn't it? Expressing an opinion, the words you use. I mean, diplomats are skilled at it, occasionally trip up and have to pay for what they say. It's usually not the diplomats, of course, who make the wordy mistakes, but our leaders are, in the end, quite unskilled at it. Here we are. You have to be careful when you say the word China. You probably have to be careful if you tell your friends these days that you're going to China on a holiday. If you do go to China, you probably need to be careful as well. But Carr, as you say, is identified as a Sinophile. He was described as a Chinese puppet by Winston Peters, which you either laugh about or you wish your defamation went for. And Carr's decided.
Yeah, I'm more at the laughing part. I mean, it's like when I can't remember we ever did a show on Mark McGowan and Clive Palmer suing each other for defamation. And I said at the time, it is utterly absurd and ridiculous that two people in politics are suing each other by having a go at one another, right? And they use colourful language and whatever else. And it was silly, but it wasn't suable. And lo and behold, after months of deliberation and millions of dollars in litigation, the judge summed it up and said, "You're both idiots. And this is ridiculous. And it's a complete waste of my time." And I see two politicians, and one ex, one current, arguing on radio, and one's going to sue each other. And I say, go home, get a nice long glass of milk, and have a lie down.
Being a little more deadly serious on the topic, Japan and the Philippines, as we say, they're in a sense in the firing line. Taiwan is right there. Our listeners ought to go back and look at the maps. You're left with the impression that that the Americans mean it when they say if there's a move on Taiwan, they'll defend. And the building up of this strategic alliance, the first island chain, the second island chain, rather tells you that you're not going to let it fall away very easily. There's that question, but there's also the question of what about the relations between the Japans, the South Koreas, the Philippines, and indeed everybody else, including Australia, with China, when you've got this sort of defence sort of material equipment situation being developed as it is.
It's a good question. I want to touch on the Taiwanese situation in particular. I said earlier that we're hopeful that this is more of a, at worst, a Cold War type situation. Certainly doesn't result in direct conflict. Taiwan is the one area which is the pointiest in all of this. It's very clear that the US really doesn't want Taiwan to fall to China and is determined to stop it. It's also equally clear that China won't relent in its desire to get Taiwan back. In fact, any slight moves by a senior Taiwanese politician, I think there was a senator that went there recently, and China was outraged and threatening all sorts of action. I think they ran military exercises at the time. It was only a senior member of Congress, Michael, that went there. Wasn't even the president or deputy or anything. It wasn't Anthony Blinken either, his Secretary of State. Any slight provocation China gets particularly fired up about around Taiwan, and US has said repeatedly, often in slightly guarded language, that it may well take military action to directly to defend Taiwan. So it's strategic ambiguity, they call it. They don't spell it out really specifically, but they drop lots of hints that they will step in militarily to defend Taiwan if it comes to that. So if you are looking for a flashpoint between India and China, between US and China, that's your place. That's where it could happen. I certainly hope it doesn't.
Our listeners will have noted that Freudian slip. We'll come back to it some other time. Of course, if you're a former politician like Tony Abbott was at the time, or former leader when he went up to Taiwan, I suppose the Chinese don't take as much notice of you, Martin.
Oh, you can get away with it. There's two things. He's not US, so it's a little bit less contentious. And if you're completely out of politics, it's a little bit less contentious as well. Remember there was a bit of eyebrows raised in and around Australia about its impact on the relationship with China, mainly because they worried that Tony Abbott would rock up in Taiwan and say a number of really inflammatory things, and that would put the make the government uneasy. Look, he made a few blithe remarks about the importance of independence of Taiwan and left it at that, I think. So it wasn't the issue that it could have been. But it's certainly, once you're out of politics, I think you're a lot less under the spotlight. It might be that a former US president, if they ever went there and made inflammatory remarks, could be interesting. But beyond that, I would think a retired PM even wouldn't really create that much of a flutter.
Martin, let's bring all this discussion to an end, perhaps in a more speculative way. I'm still trying to work out just what the import is of this article that the New York Times has run. It seems to me that it's been well briefed by the Defense Department, the Pentagon, and the think tank people, and it's got this powerful headline to it, a new Pacific arsenal to counter China. New York Times, a very independent organization, very much like Fremantle Shipping News, maybe less so. Here we are speculating on this. Do you think it's some sort of staged article? Not to do the writers a disservice, is it all in lockstep? And what do you make of the import of the article when all is said and done?
What you sometimes see, and the US, the New York Times has a very good relationship. I think they've got a lot of good contacts in the Biden administration. So it's not just their own, there's some intelligence that's coming into this. What administrations often do is they will Provide information to a media outlet, that others don't have. Allow that media outlet to run that particular story and then see what the reaction is to it. And it's very helpful, Michael, because it's not US government policy, but it's out there for people to see and listen and read and comment. And it helps them when it comes to, are we really going to commit to this? So there might be a bit of this going on as well, Michael. We haven't seen anything like this formally announced. We assume that it's actually pretty consistent with how Australia and the US and other countries have behaved. If people thought that this was real, that this made sense and it's set out well, you'd probably have a senior government official come out and talk about it. So I think there's a bit of that going on there, Michael, where the New York Times being utilised for another purpose.
Well, I'm sure one result of this will be that the Western Australian Defence Support Minister, Defence Industry Minister, Paul Papaleo, will be saying there's no doubt that Fremantle, Garden Island and Perth will be the base for these Virginia-class submarines, and we want the article corrected.
There's no doubting Paul Papaleo's passion on this matter. I think that he's fired up on many occasions about making sure WA has a piece of the manufacturing action and then is really critical to the actual defence of Australia. I can't see many of these submarines being based in Adelaide, even though they'll be predominantly made there. I can absolutely see them being based in Garden Island.
A rhetorical observation to finish with. So often in Western Australia, we think of seceding, having our own test cricket team playing international football against the eastern states, whatever they would then want to call themselves. And we could have our own defence, not just industry, but the Royal West Australian Navy. It would be really something to behold, Martin.
I guess if there's one reason why we would never, ever secede, Michael, it's because of defence. If you think about that bill that the federal government is talking about, hundreds of billions of dollars for the submarines alone, and then think about the vast coastline of Western Australia that we've got to manage, I think trying to defend Western Australia on our budget, the WA budget, would be nigh on impossible. It does probably, that the huge amount spent on defence, it's eyebrow raising. It's extraordinary.
Well, there's always the possibility of finding someone like Mr. Kemlani to broker some finance for us, Martin. Do not answer.
Oh, yeah. I've heard Clive Palmer really likes us and would like to spend a lot of money here.
Okay. Lovely talking about this. Quite sobering, and I'm sure the listeners will have enjoyed it, Martin. Thanks for your expertise.
Always a pleasure.